Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. It's day two in Chicago at the Democratic Convention, and we have terrific guests all week. Today, two of the most important and influential young black politicians in America, Don Scott, who is the Speaker of the House in the Virginia legislature, and Justin Pearson, who was the young representative in Tennessee who got kicked out by right-wing Republicans, and then his constituents sent him right back. They both are very insightful in the question of black males supporting Kamala Harris. And there are going to be other great guests, so stay tuned all week. Welcome to day two of the Democratic Convention, and James and I have two fascinating guests. Justin Pearson, who is a state representative from Memphis, Tennessee. Yeah. Among, I think, Justin's greatest accomplishments was getting kicked out of the Tennessee legislature by a bunch of right-wing Republicans.
Yes.
And then you know what the people of his district did? They sent him back. And now he's back here as a delegate to the Democratic Convention. And one of the most powerful and interesting state legislative leaders, Don Scott, who is the Speaker of the Virginia House, and has, among other things, teaching Governor Glenn Youngkin thing or two. But we want to talk to both of you about this convention. Let me just ask first, if I can, let me start with you, Mr. Speaker. What did you think of the first night?
It was amazing. If you want to talk about sacrifice, you want to talk about love of country, you have to give Joe Biden an A+. You talk about making the ultimate sacrifice to be able to step aside for love of country. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult. We're talking about the most powerful position, not in the country, in the world.
Right.
President of the United States, who gives that job up? Nobody. But Joe Biden did it. That just tells you about the love that he has for the country, the strength of his character, and his ability to step aside. He's made tremendous sacrifices in his own personal life. And I think he's able to do it because of the loss that he's had, his family, his wife and his daughter and the children, and then his son recently. The man understands how to relate and empathize with others, and I think that's what makes him such a great leader. So last night, amongst all of the many great speakers that we had last night, it was powerful. Hillary Clinton killed it. I mean, she killed it. I mean, she hit him every which way. I felt sorry for Donald Trump last night because they punished him.
Oh, no, you didn't, Mr. Speaker.
Yeah, I did. I felt, because he's outclassed. And I felt sorry because he doesn't even realize it. You know, when you don't have common sense enough to realize when you're beaten.
Yeah.
And I think Hillary and Governor Warnock and Jasmine Crockett, all those folks did an amazing job. And I think the takeaway from last night is we're ready to move forward. We're not going back. And I think the message is very clear.
What struck you about last night, Justin? Anyone in particular you think made a compelling, a different speech, a game-changing speech even?
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone met the bar and then exceeded it. I mean, the emotion that I think came through in everybody's speech was just so impactful. You think about Congresswoman Crockett, right, talking about her interaction with Vice President Harris and being emotional about just like the humanity that she was able to be seen. Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was extraordinary. I mean, I've watched her give a lot of speeches on behalf of people and stump on behalf of folks, but this was a moment where it really shows a unity that's building within the Democratic Party from all parts of it, right? And the diversity of the party, as you mentioned, Reverend Warnock. I mean, I was as excited as I've ever been. And stayed up and watched.
Are you going to say as excited as you've ever been in a convention? Of course, this is
first. My first convention. So yeah, this is the most excited I've ever been in a convention. Or two. Okay, so we're both freshmen at this. And then to actually watch President Biden, and it was really
kind of late, wasn't it?
It was a little late. You know, I do have a bedtime, but my fiance Oceanae let me stay up. When he did at the end there. Saying, you know, America, I've given my best to you, right? Like, I really tried to give everything that I could. Mm-hmm. There are very few people, right, who get to say to the country, like, I've given you everything that I've got, because he has the opportunity to. He's president of the United States, the whole thing.
Yeah.
And the fact that he really has, to the point that you rarely see somebody in a position of power, particularly a white man, a white heterosexual man in the United States of America who's also identifies as Christian, right? Like the most privilege you can get to say, like, I really did give my best. And you know what? We all felt it because we've seen it. Mm-hmm. He actually handed the party, right, the country, over to his vice president, and in an attempt and in an effort, I think, to save this Democratic constitutional experiment.
I'm going to turn this over to James, and I hear your praise of the current president, but you were probably pretty happy when he did bow out, weren't you?
I was ecstatic, yeah. Right? I mean, I had the fortune and privilege to meet President Biden. I like him, loved him as a person. I loved the way he loves his family. And I come from a big Southern family. When we met, he actually talked about the Biden boys. My parents had five sons, you know, the Pearson boys. And so I think he's an extraordinarily personable person. Vice President Harris came to Tennessee after we got expelled the next day on Good Friday. Mm-hmm. And we've gotten to know and see just like her leadership and the way she's been doing this. I haven't been as excited since President Obama was doing this when I was much younger, yeah. Right? To really see somebody who's just, when we fight, we win. Because we need to be fighting, right? We need to be fighting for what we believe in. Like, we're not going back. When there is literally a candidate who's saying, make America great again. Like, let's go back to another time period where we had fewer rights. We wouldn't all be sitting together, right? Like, this, there's a literal party of extremists that are saying, take us back. And she is given all we've got to say, no, like, together we're going to build a better, brighter future for our country. And you mentioned this, but the excitement from our peers,
oh my God,
from Gen Z, from millennials, from elders, it's unmatched to what we were seeing.
So there's a lot of talk about the disengagement of the young black male. And mm-hmm. Justin, you are currently be defined as a young black male. Mm-hmm. Don, you used to be a young black male, so you've had some experience with it. So I'll go in reverse order and ask Justin first, how do you see us re-engage? Are you seeing more engagement with the vice president? Or do you still think we have some issues as to how we can inspire or motivate these young people?
I think we, as the Democratic Party, still have issues about how we inspire and motivate young people and black people in particular, not just to be continuously voting for Democrats, but to show that voting for Democrats has and will have benefits for the black community. I think one of the things that Donald and his folks were tapping into was that black folks have been voting for Democrats for quite a while and hadn't been seeing a lot of the benefits of that. Now, under this administration, we got Ketanji Brown Jackson, which President Biden mentioned yesterday, and we've seen some of that progress. Obviously, economically, there have been some, but I do think there's still so much more that people want to see for their votes, for their consistency. And black women are the most significant and largest demographic block that always votes, like 98%. For Democrats, but we don't see that return or haven't seen it in a way that I think makes a lot of people happy. For young people, though, I think what Vice President Harris shows, right, when you don't have two 80-year-old white men running, and you put in a black woman who's about 20 years or so younger, who has been to college campuses, who speaks about gun violence prevention, who speaks about the climate and environmental crisis, who speaks about racial justice, social justice. She spoke about Sonya Massey being murdered in her home, right? Like that wasn't happening before. And it comes from a very intentional and meaningful place that I think has more people in our neck of the woods and in our community excited. And I think young folks want to see this future that we've been hoping for become more possible, and that's going to happen with Vice President Harris.
So, Mr. Speaker, you heard Representative Pearson's remarks. Would you like to augment them with some observations that you would make, too? If you weren't that long ago, you were a young black man.
Yeah, well, okay. You know, well, one of the things is I'm in the barbershop every week.
All right.
Brother's got to get a cut. And I get to learn, and look at your cut.
Well, this is a great contest.
And for us in the black community, the barbershop is holy ground.
Holy ground.
That's where you go, and you can let your hair down. You can have conversations. We can talk brother to brother. We can talk. We don't have to be politically correct. Mm-hmm. Right. We can say what we really feel. And when I'm in the barbershop now, last week, we're talking about Kamala. I don't know any brothers that's not supporting her. I don't know any brothers that's not excited mm-hmm. about this opportunity to support this black and Indian woman who mm-hmm. embraces her culture, who pledged AKA at yes. Howard University. I don't know anybody that doesn't know and can connect with her. And I think, you know, this whole idea around, you know, the demographic of black men, you know, black women have been extremely loyal to the Democratic Party, mm-hmm. but the second most loyal demographic has been black men, mm-hmm. and we should not lose sight of that, mm-hmm. and we need to be trumpeting the successes that we've had. President Biden made record investments in HBCUs. Mm-hmm. The wealth gap between black and white is closed. It's the lowest it's been in 20 years. I mean, we have to be able to articulate exactly mm-hmm. what has happened to change people's lives and improve it. I think sometimes we have to make sure that we manage what's doable from the federal government. One mm-hmm. of the things that you talked about, Justice, that I liked is it's not just about voting. It's about continuing to do the work when you're not voting.
That's
right. It's doing the work and staying engaged in community all of the time. Mm-hmm. Because when you do that, then you empower people like me, you empower people like Justin to come in, because we know the community has our back, and so we can continue to fight. But if we're only talking to people when it's time to vote, when it's election time, then we're losing. I visit, I go to churches, I do mm-hmm. stuff all year long. I visit churches all the time because I want to make sure that they don't just see me when it's election time. And I think a lot of times we make a mistake of only showing up when we're asking people to vote. So I'm hoping that mm-hmm. Vice President Harris, when she wins, because she will win, when she wins, that she will continue to stay engaged mm-hmm. in these communities and continue to talk to black men, mm-hmm. white women, mm-hmm. black women, every mm-hmm. culture, to show them this fabric of America, this whole dream that we talk about mm-hmm. is accessible for every single human being. And I think that's what makes our country great. I think having somebody like Kamala symbolizes hope. So I think black men are inspired. Like when Obama came, that energy in 08, like we couldn't believe it. Like, hold on. White people accepting a black man? Because that's what it looked like. Like, we were like, okay, if they with him, then we got to be with him. Yeah. And so now with Kamala, I think it's, again, we were like skeptical. Hold on. We know what sexism and racism looks like
right.
in America.
And that's true.
But the party is embracing Kamala. Mm-hmm. We got to be with her. And I think now things have changed so much. Mm-hmm. We didn't used to say the word abortion, yeah. you know, 8 years ago, 12 mm-hmm. years ago, 16 years ago, heck, probably 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But Roe v. Wade being overturned changed that.
Yeah.
So I think the mainstream ideas around making sure we protect reproductive health care, I think she's the perfect messenger.
Mm-hmm.
The mainstream around ideas around our children shouldn't have to go to school mm-hmm. and fear being shot. Last week I was taking my daughter to school for the first time to go get some things, and they were in the middle of an active shooter drill. This is what we're teaching our babies right now,
mm-hmm.
that it's okay that while you're trying to learn, you should be figuring out where you're going mm-hmm. to hide in the bathroom stall mm-hmm. and to be taught to stand up on the toilet and shut the door and pretend you're not in the room. We can do better than that, and I think Kamala Harris will be able to articulate that in a real way, and I think in a softer way, in a joyful way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the beauty of Kamala, and I'm going to say this is the beauty of having her on the ticket right now. We're not just voting against Trump anymore.
That's right.
We're voting for something.
That's right.
We're voting for something.
Yeah.
And that's the energy that people are coming with. That people don't understand why the Democrats are so excited. We're not voting against anybody anymore. We don't care about how crazy he is anymore. We know he's crazy.
Right.
And he picked somebody weirder than him to be his running mate, which is hard to do. But we're excited about what it looks like with the future. Like, we know that this is the energy that we need, and we know if we do the work, we can win. And that's what's so exciting about it.
Can I say one thing just about the participation in the state houses and in down ballot races is so important for Democrats as it relates to staying engaged mm-hmm. between elections, because that's where democracy is really happening, right? And when we show up, I mean, I've heard some folks on the other side, they're having building community centers in immigrant communities and lower income communities, like Republican National Convention community centers. Like, we have to go and be proximate to the communities that we care about. So we gotta go into black communities, go into immigrant communities, go where young people are, and say, like, to be a Democrat has to be a part of your identity, because Democrats show up for you, Democrats fight for you, Democrats believe in you, they believe in you having good wages, they believe in you having the freedom to choose, they believe in you having a good public education, believe in you having the ability to buy a home and not be in debt for the rest of your life or going to get education, right? Like, we have to show what we believe, and we have to show up in between elections so that when people say, oh, the Democrats, I know they're going to be with me, right? Because the other party, they don't care about us. They don't care about their own people, right? If you don't have a billionaire near your name, like, that's not, they're really not invested in you.
So you sing an Al Hunt song when you talk about these down ballot races. So, Val, I'm going to turn it over to you, because you've been very big on, like, secretaries of states and state legislatures. And state
well, I think there's two really key issues here. First of all, they're going to try to contest the selection.
Yeah.
And so therefore those secretaries of states and attorneys general and even some county people really matter a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, I mean, I'm going to turn to you in just a minute, Justin, but Mr. Speaker, Virginia has gone Democratic every year since 2008 in presidential. Is it a pretty safe bet again this time, or is it closer?
You know, I'm going to say the company line. We have to fight for every vote. We take nothing for granted.
Yeah, now tell me the real line.
The real line is we're going to kick his ass in Virginia.
Yeah.
That's the real line. He got nothing coming in Virginia. But, you know, if he wants to spend his resources in Virginia and not be spending them in Arizona and Nevada and Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania and North Carolina, hey, come on to Virginia, bro, so we can spend your money here. You got a shot, Trump. You can win Virginia. Come on. You know what I mean? But, no, he got zero chance. And so, but we have to do the work.
Yeah.
You know, nothing. You don't take it for granted. Mm-hmm. But the numbers on our side, if we turn out and do what we need to do, we can win. I mean, we won the state house in an off year.
Yeah.
When low voter turnout, that tells you that Democratic messages are working.
Mm-hmm.
Freedom, protecting the freedom to have bodily autonomy works.
Mm-hmm.
To be free from gun violence in schools and your worship places of worship,
yeah,
that works. To be able to exercise your right, your holy sacred right to
mm-hmm.
vote.
Mm-hmm.
Those are messages that people believe in. If we continue to push those messages, we win. But if we allow them to turn this into a cult of personality, which is what they've done, they you know, people talk about Democrats. We're fighting. We're having some conversations. We want a ceasefire. You know,
mm-hmm.
we want children to grow up in Israel and Gaza and be safe. Mm-hmm. We want a ceasefire. But we're having a family conversation, and it's okay.
Right.
We can withstand that.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't have those conversations. They're a cult of personality.
That's it.
And they can't have these conversations. We can have those conversations because we're a strong party. So I'm proud of Democrats for being able to let folks have some dissent,
mm-hmm.
but still know being wise enough to vote and our best interest, which is Kamala Harris. We know where Trump will be on these issues. We know where J.D. Vance will be
mm-hmm.
on these issues, and they won't be with us in our communities.
Justin, I'm old enough to remember when Tennessee produced, they voted Democrat.
Al Gore.
And they produced one of the great political leaders of our times,
mm-hmm.
former Vice President Al Gore.
Yeah.
Still spends a lot of time in Carthage, Tennessee.
Does.
But you have a tough slog. I mean, that state has turned so. It's not just Republican. They're really right-wing Republicans.
Oh, absolutely.
So when you dig down deep and you get that hope,
mm-hmm.
And your fiance convinces you that we're going to turn this thing around,
yeah.
You know, how are you going to do it? Because it really looks, I mean, on issues like you had terrible gun violence right
absolutely.
Outside the Capitol, couldn't pass anything.
Yep.
It looks, tell me why the situation is less bleak than I think it is.
Well, I mean, I think three things. One, I got faith. Right, and practice Christianity, a Christian faith that reaches into like the deep wells of our life and our story. I've sworn on a family Bible to a constitution that when it was written, called me and the speaker 3/5 of a person. Right, like this change and transformation is possible in this American constitutional democratic experiment. So there's a faith in democracy, a faith that is rooted in experiences with my religion. The second thing is my faith in people. The people who came to the Capitol, despite the fact that it's a supermajority Republican Party, the thousands of people who came and have shown up consistently, even when the cameras are not there, going to committee rooms who've never been to committee rooms before.
This is the state capitol.
At the state capitol.
Right?
At the state capitol. They're going to committee rooms testifying. They've never done that before. Going to talk to these Republicans who live in these districts who are not trying to pass any legislation. And they're saying, yep, they may not listen to me right now, but I'm going to keep showing up. That perseverance and that persistence is something that continues to give me hope. And I think the third thing is just history itself. And Reverend Warnock, he said this best. We went down to Atlanta. He said, evil always overreaches. And I think for the Republican Party, they're nothing but a snake eating their own tail. And the moment is coming where even the most extreme Republicans in our state house, one of the most extreme Republicans in our state house, lost his seat to someone who ran against him, who probably will vote just like he votes, but says, we're not that bad. Right, we don't have to say, we don't have to ban reparations or the study of reparations,
mm-hmm.
right? We don't have to act as though we're overseers to the black legislators. That's one of the most extreme folks in the state house lost his election. And so even Republicans are getting tired of these radical extremist Republicans who are not conservative, who do not believe in the, I sound more conservative most days. That, I mean, you know, I sound like a 2000 conservative, right? I'm talking about local control.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about the Constitution and we the people, right? Like these are values that for a long time were associated with the Republican Party, but they've been lost to the cult of personality and they've been lost to ideologies of identity and preservation of whiteness rather than the protection of people who are the most vulnerable. And in Tennessee, what I think is happening is a multiracial, multi-socioeconomic, intergenerational movement of people who are saying, I actually don't want to die from gun violence. I don't want you to either. Wait, I think it's important that we have clean air and clean water and clean soil. And it's not a Democrat or Republican issue. It's like, what's right and what's wrong? And going back to our morals, like, 9 times out of 10, we are right on these moral issues, mm-hmm. right? I just say the 1%, the 10% for the other people. But we're right on these
issues.
You're
not going to talk about the 10.
Yeah, no.
James Carville.
I hear a lot of people said, you know, we need people in politics that actually had a life, that bring some experience to the table. And Mr. Speaker, I'm going to ask you to talk about your bio, because I'm pretty sure you've had a life. I'm pretty sure you've seen life in the way that some other people see life. Yeah. So please take time and share.
I think my life experience is, I think the most important trait of a leader is empathy.
Yes.
Being able to empathy. You know, people used to say that Bill Clinton felt your pain. Mm. You know, you have to have gone through something to feel that pain, because you felt that pain before. Yeah. And you know how to empathize, and you know how to sympathize. And in my life, you know, I grew up single mom, 6 kids, went to Texas A&M University. That's why I speak conservatism. I went to the most conservative school in Texas.
Yeah.
Went to the Navy. I was a surface warfare officer in the Navy. Went to LSU Law School, the most conservative school in Louisiana. With all due respect, James Carville, who also is an LSU Law
Mike writer. Johnson. You know?
And then in my third year of law school, I got arrested. I was convicted. I went to prison for a drug conspiracy. I went to pick up some drug money. Next thing I know, I'm in a crack cocaine conspiracy. I was sentenced to 10 years in federal prison. People told me my life was over. I was done. I would never be anything. I went to prison. I served my time. I did 7 years and 8 months, but who's counting? Mm-hmm. Came home in 2002. That was in 94. Came home in 2002 and began, because I had that faith, because I had this praying mother, these praying grandmothers and aunties, that they would pour all on you.
They didn't
just lay their hands on you. They put all on your head. Yeah. And you could not help but have the same faith that they had and the same belief in yourself that they had. They would not let you fail. Mm-hmm. And so in my mind, I had to continue to fight. Mm-hmm. And I worked at the same company. I started at the bottom, and I went to the very top. I started a company. I was like the lowest that you could be a case manager. Mm-hmm. And when I left that company, I was a senior vice president. And in 2014, I decided to take a bar exam in Virginia. Now, that's 20 years after I finished law school. I took the bar for the first time in Virginia, passed it, and I was sworn in. You know, they check everything when they do a character fitness check. So they had to check everything. They looked at all of my stuff, my credit report. They did the exam, talked to my old friends, my new friends, everybody, and they allowed me to begin practice. I started practicing a lot. Now I'm a partner at a firm, and I decided to run. And everybody told me I shouldn't run. Don, you got that felony, you can't win. You need to be quiet, you need to sit down, you know. Mm. But if it had not been for the Lord on my side, you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I knew that he had a purpose for me, and it was to be able to tell this story. And so where other people told me to be quiet and be embarrassed and be ashamed, I was being told, in my heart and my spirit, share your story. Because there are other people who've had these experiences where they felt like they got a bad break, and it was straight unfair, and they didn't think they could come back from it, and you can do it. And not only did I do that, I won in 2020, and then I couldn't believe it. 2 years after I'm sworn in, I become the minority leader. After I'm like, what? I'm the minority leader, y'all sure it's me? And I get selected to be the minority leader. And when I became minority leader, June 1st, 2022, and there are people on my staff in this room, probably a month later, I said, we're gonna win the majority. Because we've only had the majority in Virginia for 3 years out of the last 24 years. And I said, we're gonna win this majority, we're gonna take back the House. And we did. We did the work. We got the House back, and now we got to keep it next year.
So I just want to thank you for allowing me to share that. That's the short version,
but that's the story.
To graduate from LSU Law in 1994 and to pass the bar in 2014 is an incredible experience. Why do I say this? So I think that we have an inferior law school. No, I don't. But you learned a different system. Mm-hmm. So the property law you learned in law school in Louisiana is different.
Yeah,
different words, different everything. Yeah. You know, the other places you have statute of limitations, we have prescription. Yeah. And to be able to do that, and I think Virginia is a multi-state.
Yeah.
So it's all, not, so you literally had to, 20 years after law school, you really literally had to reinvent the wheel.
Yeah.
So I want people to understand this is a magnificent accomplishment in life. And I just turn it back to Al, but I sent to Mark Warner last night, and he thinks that Don Scott is like the most effective political figure he's seen in Virginia politics in a long time. And that's high praise coming from a guy that's never lost an election. He was governor of Virginia many terms.
He lost one. He lost to John Warner.
Mark
Warner ran against John.
He lost.
Warner
he got beat by John.
Yeah,
okay,
and,
so
but,
he did
but it was a great. They were very.
And then they were friends. And then John Warner endorsed him.
And John Warner endorsed him.
In 2013. Okay. Yeah.
This is the first time I've ever been able to correct James Carville.
That's right. I stand gladly
I'm
corrected.
I'm here for more history, Justin.
I stand gladly corrected, Albert.
Just finally, I want to ask both of you a question. Just short. First of all, Justin, what was your feeling when those right wingers expelled you from the Tennessee State House?
Mm-hmm. Righteous indignation. Oshane and I got 44 minutes of sleep the night before working on our speeches, our rebuttal, going through the resolution. She's now in law school. First day was yesterday. Good job. But we went through line by line preparing, not knowing how the process would actually be for our expulsion. I didn't learn exactly what would happen until the day we were actually expelled.
Just tell us quickly why you were expelled.
Oh, yeah. On March 27th, 2023, the largest mass shooting in Tennessee happened at the Covenant School, an elementary school, right, where six people were killed. Three of them were 9-year-old children. Hmm. 2 days later, 7,000 people marched on the Capitol, mostly kids under the age of 18, asking for us to do something, to ban assault weapons, just anything. We went inside of the House floor and wanted to speak to them during welcoming and honoring, you know, this period at the beginning, to say we want to welcome the protesters, the people who are asking for us to do something. The Speaker refused to allow for us to speak, moved the agenda forward. And every time that a bill would come up that I had questions about, I would start off saying, we need to do something about gun violence. And I was reprimanded 4 times and was told I was going to be censured if I continued. Went out, talked to people in the galleries, and told them, like, let's keep going, let's keep pressing. Went back. My voting machine was turned off. Never has anyone's voting machine ever been turned off on the House floor. But this day it was turned off because we weren't at work. Then I went to the gallery, talked to Oshane. I was like, me, Rep. Jones, like, we think we have to do something now. And we talked to Rep. Johnson and actually one other person. And she was like, no, I think you all should. And so I went back down, I talked to Justin, Rep. Jones, and he said, okay, let's do it. And then I was like, okay, let's figure out the timing. And I wanted to do it between bills, so it wouldn't be as disruptive, if you will. And then I was like, all right, let's go. And so I tapped him. We went down to Gloria Johnson's desk, Representative Johnson's desk, went in between bills after a charter bill got passed, and went to the floor and said, you know, no action, no peace. And our state is better than this. And the Tennessee Firearms Association, National Rifle Association that has bought and purchased the people who are in these seats, don't have the final say for us. The majority of Tennesseans, 71%, want red flag laws, including MAGA Republicans. Our state house is completely out of touch and out of sync with the majority of people in our state, but we've been gerrymandered into this reality. After that, it would be 3-4 days later, expulsion papers were written up. It'd be 1 week later, and on April 6th of 2023, where Representative Jones would be expelled, Gloria Johnson, who's white, she was saved, and then I was expelled from the state house. And I mean, we had done all we could to not be expelled. I didn't want my district to lose representation. I did not expect what happened afterward to happen as well, but we fought as hard as we could because I lost my classmate to gun violence in January of last year, just a few months before this happened. My mentor, she was killed the fall before this happened. Like, this isn't something that's just a happenstance for us. This is a real problem. And laws are impacting this. And before I was a legislator, Speaker, I would say, you know, I'd do the thoughts and prayers thing, just like as a person. Like, I hate this really happened. Mm-hmm. You know, my family's praying, we're all doing that. But once you have power, you shouldn't just be offering thoughts and prayers. Mm-hmm. You can actually do something. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that Tennessee Republicans refused to do something, when that's all everybody was asking for us to do, the only action that we could take was go into the well of the House floor. And so by the time we get to the speech and are expelled, I really am, and I still remain righteously indignant that I know we were doing the right thing for the right reason, for the people who will never be able to protest. Mm-hmm. They'll never be able to stand up and say, you all need to pass a law, because they've been murdered by political cowardice against these gun lobbyists. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, we have a responsibility to do everything that we can to protect children, to protect our communities. We swore not to do things injurious to the community. Like, this is what we're supposed to be doing. And so despite their reaction and gross overreaction and miscalculation, as my mama said, what the devil meant for bad, God will turn into good. And I think now the movement to end gun violence is even stronger. Since then, the White House launched the Office of Gun Violence Prevention. Mm-hmm. More organizations have popped up in Tennessee that are starting to coordinate and navigate this situation better. Like, you can't stop this movement. And that's why I said we got a back. You can't expel a movement.
Mm-hmm. You can't stop Justin Pearson. You're back in the Tennessee legislature.
There you go.
So let me ask you, Don Scott, your governor has attracted national attention. Some people even thought he might be Trump's running mate, and they say if Trump loses, he'll be a front runner for 2028. Mm. What's your take? You deal a lot with Governor Glenn Youngkin. What's your take?
The best compliment I'd give him is he's not totally crazy. Mm. You know, I think he's more performative, MAGA performative, and doing the things that he has to do. I think he believes some of it. Mm-hmm. I don't think he believes all of it. I think he's an amateur when it comes to politics. I haven't been around that long, but I think I kind of understand the game and things and how you have to do the things you need to do. I think he's like a consultant. He came from Carlyle Group. Everything he did was like a venture capitalist. Come in, have a big backdrop, and come in like a consultant with a big backdrop and drop a new tagline down. I mean, he's all style, no substance. Mm-hmm. And he hadn't accomplished anything as governor. I mean, for the most part, the Democratic legislature runs the Commonwealth of Virginia. We've done all of the work. He gets to come along and tag along. We're in the majority. There's only so much he can do. Now, what he has done, to his credit, is put in a lot of extremists in positions of power. He put in the lady who wrote the education section of Project 2025. Oh, I say Project 2025 is trying to take us back to 1619.
That's right. That's right.
And so that is the whole goal of Project 2025, get us back to 1619, because this is the issue. I mean, they try to muddle it in a whole lot of different language. You know, they hate DEI, but they hate anything that's going to help marginalized communities forward. And so I think, the governor he's still learning on the job. He's lame duck. Starting January, he's lame duck. He's done. Mm-hmm. I mean, he won't have any say. He doesn't get to, he's going to sign whatever budget we give him. And for the most part, we kind of bullied him into submission. Mm-hmm. He came in hot because he beat Terry McAuliffe. He beat a legend.
He did.
To his credit, he beat a legend. And he thought he had a mandate, which he didn't. And we had to, kind of educate him on who, the legislature in Virginia is forever. The governor's a one-term governor. The legislature is forever. And so what we had to help him understand that he has one goal, to be president of the United States. Everything he's done with he and his consulting group around him is to posture to be president. Mm-hmm. He does not care about everyday hard work in Virginians. He doesn't care about the little guy. Mm-hmm. The man is so extreme. He banned a bill that would force insurers to pay for contraception. So we're not even talking about abortion. Okay, you're conservative, you're against abortion. Why are you against contraception? Why are you against the IVF? This is beyond the pale.
Because you hate women.
And you hate women.
That's right.
And they want to control women, mm-hmm. period. They want women to know their place. Mm-hmm. And that's everything that he does and everything that he says. And so I think, they want to privatize public education. They want to take public education away and privatize schools. And they want to change how we're grading schools. So they can, at first they invented SOL so they could try to show public schools are failing. Mm-hmm. That didn't work. Mm-hmm. We stepped up to the plate. Now they want to take away SOLs and come up with a new system to make the schools look like they're failing so then that they could privatize them and create all these charter schools and lab schools and experimental schools so that wealthy people don't have to pay real estate taxes to educate poor people. Mm-hmm. That's the basic. But they don't understand that they have to do that to win. They have to cheat to win, and they're not going to win long. And so I think the state will go back to a Democratic governor next time. Abigail Spanberger is on is running for governor. She unopposed at this moment, but on a Democratic ticket. I think she's going to win. And when she wins, and we keep the House of Delegates in 2025, I'll remain Speaker. Amen.
Amen.
And we will get some transformative stuff done. We passed red flag laws in Virginia. Yeah. So when I think about Tennessee, just sitting here talking to you, it's amazing to me, and forgive me. We're neighboring states.
Yeah.
Like, the cultures that we have are so similar. Mm-hmm. But it's like we're a million miles away as far as policy, because we're protecting reproductive health care in Virginia. We passed red flag laws. We banned all those CS. We passed a Voting Rights Protection Act. We have 45-day early voting. Like, you look at it, you say, wow, what?
Can you see the envy in Justin's eyes right now?
That's hope.
But not only the envy, I'm telling him this because I know they can do it.
Yeah, right?
Because we are neighbors.
That's right.
So these are the same people. This is the same culture, mm-hmm. same conversations. It can happen. Mm-hmm. We just have to continue to put in that work, and I think we can do it.
So, James, you know, there is a cliche that you can't teach old dogs new tricks, but I got to tell you something. You know, we're two old white guys. We learned a hell of a lot from these, really important black leaders today. It really has been a great, great session.
Yeah, sure. So before I go, and I know we all got to get out here, I'm a little bit of a college professor in me. And the word woke became a big explosive thing, all right? Mm-hmm. And people, I'm actually pro-woke.
Yes.
Because the origin of the word is this. The first time it was used, and I researched it, was by a jazz musician named Leadbelly Ledbetter, who was born in Caddo Parish outside of Shreveport, I think died in a Houston jail. Mm-hmm. And the first context of the word woke is that black people should be woke in the interactions with the police, mm-hmm. which in 1925, Southeast Texas, Louisiana, was probably a pretty good idea.
That's a good idea. You might want to be woke.
You may consider staying away. If you're in Shelby County and you're in Memphis, you might want to, even if you're a state legislator, if they pull you off, you might just be a little bit woke.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm very pro-woke, guys.
And I think it came about from the George Floyd incident. You know, people, and we were I'll put it like this. To me, woke came from, black people were already woke. We've always been awake. We had to be awake in this country.
That's right.
And I think what happened was we were saying, white people, Jordan, thank you, you woke now. We hope that you see what's going on now. Your eyes are open, and I think that's what it meant. Mm-hmm. And now I think for someone to try to take it and spin it and twist it, and, you know, I think, you know, as I look at Justin, great young leader, beast, I'm so proud of you, that word woke, is people like, we're awakening these young folks to use their voice.
That's right.
Like, it's okay to speak up right now. You don't have to wait till you're 50 to start leading. You can start leading right now because you're not going to be the same. Every day you're growing. You're not the guy you were in 2023 already. You've already grown leaps and bounds above what everybody else has done. So I'm just grateful. And this is the last thing I'm going to say about being a black leader. Being a black leader is not enough.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be excellent when you get in these rooms.
That's right.
You have to be excellent. You have to speak truth to power.
That's right.
You have to be organized. Mm-hmm. I start on time. I finish on time. My yes is my yes. My no is my no.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody knows where I'm coming from.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't play. Yeah. And they know that.
Well, thank y'all guys. I just had to get something in. But, remember,
for now,
stay woke.
Stay woke.
Everybody stay woke.
You were great guests. Thank you so much.
All right, Justin, you were a hero,
man. Appreciate you, Ray.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.